Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 97th Interpreters for Sure Roundtable. Tonight we'll be discussing Lesson 47 in the Gospel Doctrine Old Testament Manual, discussing Ezra, Nehemiah, some really great history, and other stuff. This evening we have Daniel Peterson, Stephen Smoot, and myself, Cassandra Hedulius, moderating. Thought we'd give Dan a break for once now that the year's almost over. And if you have your scriptures in your manual, go ahead to Lesson 47. And we're going to go ahead and let Stephen start us off with some historical background. We're talking about Israel in exile.
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking a little about Israel after the exile. So it's interesting because I think where we last left off in the roundtables was Ezekiel, which is Israel in exile. Ezekiel is a prophet of the exile. You'll recall that this is in the middle of the 6th century BC. So it begins in 586 BC, and it's going to end in 539 BC or thereabouts. And what we're looking at in Ezra and Nehemiah in some of these later books is what's going on directly after the exile. So to give you a little bit of perspective here, you'll recall that the Babylonians conquer Judah and subjugate the Judahites and send them off to Babylon and Mesopotamia to be resettled and to be assimilated.
And by Judahites, meaning the southern kingdom, right?
That's right. That's right. So meaning the southern kingdom of Judah. You'll recall that the northern kingdom of Israel had already, at this point, been decimated by the Assyrians. And they were, for all intents and purposes, long off the scene. What we're talking about here are specifically the southern tribe of Judah being taken off into captivity into Babylon. And they're going to be there for about a generation, for about 40 or 50 years is how long they're going to be captive. Ezekiel and Daniel and some of these other prophets are going to prophesy during this time. But we have something very interesting happen in the late 6th century. So there's a Babylonian king, Nabonidus, who is particularly unpopular amongst the Babylonians. And he is going to be overthrown and succeeded by actually not a Babylonian king, but a Persian king, the Persian king Cyrus. And Cyrus is going to gather, well, first he's going to conquer the Achaemenids, and then he's going to establish the Persian dynasty and empire and go over westward to conquer the Babylonians and others. And there's something interesting about what Cyrus does, because it's actually recorded in a neat little inscription called the Cyrus Cylinder. It's about that big. It's a clay cylinder that has cuneiform written along the sides. And it actually chronicles, from the Persian perspective, how Cyrus came to dominate Babylon. And I want to read a couple lines from it to give you an idea, and then I'll mention why this is significant historically. So it begins by talking about an incompetent person was installed to exercise lordship over his country. It's probably talking about Nabonidus, the Babylonian king. And he's particularly unpopular, so it says, by his own plan, he did away with the worship of Marduk, the king of the gods. He continually did evil against Marduk's city. So he's not a very good guy. People don't like him. So it says, Marduk turned towards all the inhabitants that were abandoned and all the people of Sumer and Akkad who had become corpses. It portrays this king as a very sort of tyrannical guy. And Marduk is going to raise up Cyrus. He says this. The cylinder says this. He surveyed and looked throughout all the lands, searching for a righteous king whom he would support. He called out his name, Cyrus, king of Anshan. He pronounced his name to be king over all the world. And it goes on to say how Marduk, the Babylonian god, brings up Cyrus to conquer the Babylonians, which is kind of interesting. And here's what Cyrus says. I am Cyrus, king of the world, great king, mighty king, king of Babylon, king of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four quarters. And he goes on and on and on, right? So definitely not a giant egotistical guy there, that Cyrus. He's very humble. But he will go on to say this. When I entered Babylon in a peaceful manner, I took up my lordly reign in the royal palace amidst rejoicing and happiness. Marduk, the great lord, caused the magnanimous people of Babylon, and I daily attended to his worship. So it's very ingratiating to himself, right? I'm this great guy who came and restored worship of Marduk, and everybody loved me, and everything was great, you know. But this is where it becomes significant for the return from the exile, to the Judahites returning back to the land of Israel. It says this later on in the text. I returned the images of the gods to the sacred centers on the other side of the Tigris, whose sanctuaries had been abandoned for a long time, and I let them dwell in eternal abodes. I gathered all of their inhabitants and returned to them their dwelling. In addition, at the command of Marduk, the great lord, I settled their inhabitations in pleasing abodes, the gods of Sumer and Akkad, whom Nabonidus, to the anger of the lord of the gods, had brought to Babylon. So what he's saying here, if you're, of course, you know, paying attention to what's going on in the Hebrew Bible, Cyrus is reversing what the Babylonians had done to their conquered peoples. So the Babylonian procedure was conquer these individuals, haul off the inhabitants and their cult images and their gods to Babylon to glorify Babylon, but that makes everybody upset. So Cyrus says he's commanded by Marduk to do the opposite. So he returns local people to their local lands, he reinstitutes or allows them to reinstitute the cult of worship, and allows them to gather again. And this is going to allow the Judahites to return to Israel at the end of the 6th century. This is going to allow them to reestablish the temple, reestablish worship of Yahweh, and begin to develop what becomes normative Judaism as we understand it, and as it's practiced today. So this is highly significant that Cyrus does this. If he hadn't, the history may have turned out very differently.
So really quick, sorry to interrupt you, but
go ahead.
I mean, we joke about Cyrus having kind of a big head about his own importance, but in terms of a king of an ancient major civilization and empire, was that unusual? Was he, you know, really unique in that respect of letting people have their right to worship and even go back to their homelands?
No? Not entirely. So, for example, the Assyrians would let you do your own thing if you just didn't cause trouble. But what Cyrus does is revolutionary in that he reverses this really, or he's very reactionary against what the Babylonians had done. The policy of the Babylonians generally was to haul them off back to Babylon and assimilate them there. And what's so revolutionary about Cyrus is not what he's doing, but the scale on which he's doing it, okay? He's actively sort of not just permitting, but by some accounts it seems he's also actively sort of participating in resettling individuals back in their native homeland. And there's a reason he does this. It's purely strategic and political. You can probably imagine how upset you would be if you were forcefully exiled to a foreign land, to a foreign nation, being forced to worship foreign gods. And for some guy to come around and to reverse that, and to actively be helping you reestablish, you know, what your old ways were, what your traditional cultural ways were, you can imagine how happy you'd be with that guy. So Cyrus, knowing the way the wind was blowing, knew if I can appease all these dispersed and scattered people who the Babylonians have conquered, I can reestablish them, I can give them, you know, some measure of security and safety, that will make me a popular guy. And it seems to have done just that, right? He seems to become a pretty popular guy amongst, you know, in the empire, amongst the peoples he had conquered. So to answer your question, it's not like entirely unique. You know, this wasn't some like just absolutely unheard of thing that he was doing. But the scale on which he was doing it and the measures that he was actively taking to try to enact this is very significant and seems to be unique in that sense, or, you know, especially significant in that sense. So I hope that kind of helps answer that. It's a good question. But to sort of wrap things up now, because we've droned on and on about Cyrus. Well, by the way, I will mention, if you go read Isaiah chapter 45, you'll see Cyrus mentioned there. And Cyrus is called Yahweh's Messiah, Yahweh's Anointed One. So it wasn't just Marduk, apparently, but also Yahweh, who thought pretty highly of Cyrus. And the Jews, of course, thought very highly of him. And so that's why he's very significant in the history of Judaism. He's the only non-Israelite, he's the only Gentile, who's called a Messiah in the Hebrew Bible. But so what's going to happen is the Jews, the exiles, are going to return to Judah. They're going to resettle themselves. But there's going to be significant changes. Politically, we now have governors, Persian governors. Sanballat is the guy from Nehemiah that's the governor that Nehemiah is going to, you know, have some problems with. We're going to have a local governor looking over things. Language-wise, no longer is Hebrew the predominantly spoken language. Now it's Aramaic. And Aramaic is going to become very influential. Parts of Ezra and Daniel are written in Aramaic, and this reflects their composition during this time. Culturally, we have run-ins between the returning exiles and the already native people there that we now know as the Samaritans, And that's going to cause some problems later on, because we know the ethnic struggles or tensions are going to happen between the pure Israelites and the Samaritans. Economically, you know, just culturally, socially, there's going to be these significant changes. Religiously, which we may talk about, there's going to be changes. We see the rise of sort of normative or formative Judaism around this time. Post-exilic Israelite religion is markedly different from pre-exilic Israelite religion in many ways. So in a number of ways, this is very significant, this return and post-exilic Israel. And it's significant to understand the context as you read Ezra and Nehemiah and Zechariah and Haggai and some of these other later prophets. You can understand the dynamics going on with the people, the dynamics going on in Israel, and what they're reacting to as they sort of engage in this resettling and hopeful reestablishment of Israel, which is what they're ultimately going to do.
Give me a really quick nutshell answer. What are, say, two ways that post-exilic Israelite religion was different from pre-exile?
The one really significant way seems to be a really strong, marked monotheism that we now associate with Judaism. That seems to arise exile and post-exile. Pre-exilic Israelite religion was not strictly monotheistic in the sense that we understand it today, or the way that we associate monotheism with Judaism today. The really sort of strong monotheism of the later chapters of Isaiah and some other texts in the Hebrew Bible, that seems to be a product of the exile and post-exile influence. So there's one significant way. Another significant way is, and this comes a little later, but the seeds are planted by Ezra and Nehemiah, is you're going to see a rise in a really strong sort of legalistic Judaism, you can say, a sort of Judaism that really goes back to the Torah Moshe, so the Law of Moses, okay? Not to say that Law of Moses, or at least the general principles and statutes of Law of Moses weren't important before or weren't enacted before, but after the exile, there's going to be a really strong return to the book, right, the law, and it's going to really take central focus in post-exilic Judaism. This will, of course, lead to the rise of Pharisees and Sadducees and Essenes and Zealots and other Jewish sects that are going to interpret it differently, but a lot of it hinges on now, we're a people of the book. We have this book, this Law of Moses, that we're going to really make our sort of central authority and command now in a way that was much more marked than pre-exilic Israel. So those two ways, I would say, really stand out in showing the difference between post- and pre-exilic Israelite religion.
Awesome. I would say, by the way, that you see that personified in a way in Ezra himself, that Ezra is not a king, and he's a priest, yes, but really he's Ezra the scribe. It's the beginning of the coming to dominance of that kind of book-learned Judaism, which when the temple eventually disappears in 70 AD, will lead to the rise of the rabbi class, because the law itself becomes a kind of replacement for the temple. It doesn't yet, but you can see that the seeds are being sown, as was mentioned, for that kind of development, where a scribe is really important, who reads the law to the people, who derives at least part of his authority, not merely from the fact that he's a priest, but from the fact that he's learned in the law. He knows the Law of Moses very, very well. And so, kings are gone now. You're not going to have kings in the same sense that you had before. Zerubbabel, who shows up here, is the last, as far as I know, the last descendant of David who has kind of civil authority. After that, it's going to be a rule of priestly classes who function more and more as aristocrats. And then eventually, when they lose their role with the destruction, the ultimate destruction of the temple, it's the scribes. In a sense, you can see Ezra as a kind of proto-rabbi. He's beginning that evolution toward rabbinical authority in Judaism. And, in Isaiah and all the previous books, you see a lot of, to go back to this idea of the rise of monotheism, you see a lot of concern about the Israelite propensity to worship idols. You don't see that much after the time of the return from the exile. There are other issues on righteousness and so on, but it's not so much a seeking after, whoring after false gods. There are other questions in their minds. Not keeping the law faithfully, but not so much idolatry or being taken in by Baal worship or something like that.
Yeah, you're going to see at this time a rise in... We today, and this is kind of unfair, but today we associate this with the really sort of nitpicky nature of Judaism, you know, haggling over these little, you know, aspects of the law. You know, we sort of caricature that into how legalistic and rigid Judaism is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the time of Ezra, you're right, Dan, that it's going to become not so much a matter of worshiping false gods. That's still an issue, but it's going to be more how do we interpret the law correctly? Because this is what we have, right, is the law, and this is what has been handed to us. You're going to see these rise in these sects of Judaism that are really going to, you know, haggle each other over little things that to them are highly significant, since it's become the new sort of the new danger is not interpreting the law correctly, right? So something this sort of goes along there with what you were saying.
Right.
So Dan, you said that there's kind of the kingship of Israel ends at this point. Is there not a line from Zerubbabel to like Herod in the time of Christ?
There's still a Davidic line, but they play a minimal role. You know, by the time Christ comes along, we're told that Christ is of the line of David, but they have no role in the rulership of the community or anything like that. It's the priestly families and the Maccabees and so on who are ruling by the time of Jesus. But no longer the Davidic kings. There's a dream of a return of the Davidic monarchy, but you really don't get it.
And then is there not really a role of a prophet anymore either? There's no more...
You still have some prophets, you know, contemporary with the story of Ezra and Nehemiah, you get Haggai and Zechariah, who are prophesying, who are supporting the rebuilding of the temple, for example. But we're coming pretty close to the end of the prophetic tradition in Israel as well, at least the canonical prophetic tradition. And that too will lead to a change to where it's no longer a matter of living prophets, but of revering the words of the past prophets that have been written down in what will eventually become a canonical Old Testament or Hebrew Bible.
And so it's a very different thing. And that's what allows all of these factions to come up, that you can't just turn to the prophet and say, how do we interpret this? But instead they all argue amongst themselves.
Yeah, there's certainly no single person who has the authority to answer these questions. It's a matter of academic, scholastic interpretation, and that's everybody's game. You know, as a lawyer, how that works. It's very much that kind of thing, that people are arguing about the meaning of the law, and courts will rule different ways. Lawyers will argue, sometimes even sincerely, different ways about the interpretation of the law. And, you know, but that's the kind of thing you get. It's reduced to interpretation of texts to a large extent rather than going to a living oracle. That will eventually sort of fade. And so there's the veneration of an effectively closed canon. There's no time where the Lord says the canon is closed. They just... new deposits into the canon ceased being made not too long after this.
Okay. And then, so Ezra himself, and you can look at this in the lesson manuals too, we have this book of Ezra, chapters 1 through 8, but Ezra, the actual man named Ezra, doesn't even show up until chapter 7. Before then,
right.
It's the pre-Ezra history with Zerubbabel and Jeshua lead the first group of Jews back to Jerusalem, and then the second wave under Nehemiah, is that right?
Mm-hmm. There's some dispute about whether Nehemiah might have come first or not, but the usual view is that Ezra did.
And then just anybody teaching this is probably going to want to pull out their Bible maps, too. So, roughly, you can think of Babylon as being modern-day Iraq, correct?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Persia as modern-day Iran. I know and love one Iranian Mormon, actually the only Iranian Mormon that I have ever heard of. And it actually is very meaningful to her, these passages, that a Persian king was so helpful and instrumental to the preservation of Israel. So,
the
Rus, as it's pronounced in Persian, if you want to impress any Persians in your midst, the Rus is quite a revered figure.
Yes, he is. And that name is still used occasionally by modern-day Iranians.
Oh,
I've known some people who bore the name.
So what can one of you tell us about the temple? Because, of course, they get back to Jerusalem, and their, it seems like their A number one thought is, we need to build the temple. And how did that go, and how does that connect to the temple that we then see at the beginning of the New Testament?
Well, by the way, let me say something about that map. You mentioned getting out the map. The route that they have to take from Babylon back is an interesting one. You notice that in earlier history, the threat is always coming from the north. You know, it's Syria is threatened. The northern kingdom goes first, then the southern kingdom. It's about 500 miles from Babylon, roughly, to Palestine. That's as the crow flies, but nobody wants to travel as the crow flies there because it takes you across deserts. So what they have to do is go about 900 miles up the Euphrates River and then down the coast where there's some greenery for themselves and some water for themselves and for their animals. But, of course, the temple's been destroyed. There's essentially nothing left but the foundation. And this isn't the Judaism yet that can dispense with the temple. They have yearned for the temple. They've wanted it back. And so one of their highest priorities is to rebuild it. And it will be rebuilt. This is the second temple. And the second temple is a humbler operation. There's even some account in these books of the people who knew the former temple being a little disappointed when they finally saw the second temple. It wasn't as grand as Solomon's temple. But on the other hand, it will now last for a long time. It's never really destroyed. It's just gradually rebuilt, redone, renovated, added to, and when it finally is, in a sense, destroyed, that's by Herod, who wants to build a more spectacular thing. Then, of course, his temple is destroyed in 70 AD, but they find the temple, you know, this is, as I say, this is a Judaism that still revolves around sacrificial offerings, still has a functioning Levitical priesthood, and so it's an imperative for them to rebuild the temple. And there's a really touching scene in Ezra where it says that that the people there, the older priests and so on, who had seen the previous temple, they're crying so much when the foundation is laid. There are cheers and huzzas, but there's also weeping, and the noise was so loud you really couldn't distinguish the weeping of joy from the cheers and the applause and the ovation. When the foundation is laid, to me that's a very human, very touching scene. So
the other thing I'll just mention quickly about the temple that's very interesting from our Latter-day Saint perspective is the dedication that follows the temple. Just like with Solomon's temple, we have a dedicatory sort of service for the temple, which includes a sort of a covenant renewal ceremony that Ezra leads the people in. When they return and they begin this new work on the temple, in this new temple service. That's significant for us, of course. We can tie it in with the Book of Mormon, with such examples as King Benjamin tying in a covenant renewal ceremony with the temple and his people. So this is the thing that you do, right, when you reestablish a temple, or when you sort of have these marked transition periods. Joshua does it when they come to the Promised Land. He does a covenant renewal ceremony. Ezra does it when they're working on the temple and they come back from exile. It's very interesting, this pattern. Solomon does it, of course, when he dedicates the temple. It's very interesting that you have this continual covenant renewal ceremony that, from our Latter-day Saint perspective, should make us think about, you know, renewing our covenants when we go to the temple and the covenants we make there. And to think about it, when we dedicate temples, you know, try to get yourself in this mindset that this is something new, and so we're going to rededicate ourselves as well to the temple and to the service done in there. So from both an ancient and a modern perspective, it's neat to read Ezra and Nehemiah and to see these covenants being renewed, the temple being rededicated and renewed, the city of Jerusalem, even the walls of Jerusalem are dedicated and renewed, and they make a big deal about that. So some interesting continuity there, I think, you can see from biblical times to our own modern worship today.
Yeah, and you mentioned King Benjamin. If I can just jump in and pick up on that, because I don't know otherwise if we'll get to it, but in Nehemiah 8, you have the account of Ezra, and he's standing on a pulpit, it says, or a platform before all the people. He reads the law to them. This is very much like King Benjamin's address in the Book of Mosiah, that he stands on a tower that's been made so that he can address the people. He's at the temple. And then they celebrate a Feast of Tabernacles. It says they hadn't done one like this since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun. probably doesn't mean that, well, we know that they'd celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles since then, but probably not with as much joy or enthusiasm. But it tells about how they remember this law that they should dwell in booths in the feast of the seventh month, and so they go out and they gather up olive branches and pine branches and myrtle branches and palm branches, and they build these little booths and so on. You remember that each family at King Benjamin's address sits in its little tent to listen to the address. Reading Nehemiah 8 really sheds light on that chapter in King Benjamin's address in Mosiah, where they're all, to my mind, clearly celebrating something like a Feast of Tabernacles.
And then, Dan, could you tell us really quick what you had pointed out in your notes about the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah? There's a lot of overlap and kind of what biblical scholarship has thought about and decided in terms of authorship and, just about those two books.
Yeah, you know, the earliest Hebrew manuscripts combine Ezra and Nehemiah. They're often referred to, even in scholarly literature, as Ezra-Nehemiah. You go back to some ancient sources, of course, they're much later than Ezra or Nehemiah, but Josephus, for example, in the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, seemed to be unaware of a separate book of Nehemiah. They just don't know that there is one. And in the oldest Hebrew manuscripts and in the oldest Greek translations, the oldest Septuagint manuscripts, the books are combined, they're treated as one book. It's only in the 3rd century that the Christian father, the Greek Christian father Origen of Alexandria, distinguishes the two books. But he calls them not Ezra and Nehemiah, but 1st Ezra and 2nd Ezra. And then Jerome in the Latin Vulgate, which is created about the end of the 4th century, beginning of the 5th, refers to Nehemiah as 2nd Ezra, Ezra or 2nd Esdras. Even in the first English translations, translation of Wycliffe or Wycliffe in 1382 or Miles Coverdale in 1535, you get 1st and 2nd Esdras rather than Ezra and Nehemiah. It's about 1448 that you get the book separated in a Hebrew manuscript. And now, of course, we commonly call them Ezra and Nehemiah. It's thought that Ezra was composed around 440 BC, Nehemiah maybe about 430 BC, but no one really knows. The speculation is because of certain linguistic and thematic peculiarities that are uniform between the two of them, but unlike anything else, that they were possibly, very probably in a way, written by the same author. Some people have even argued that the author of Ezra and Nehemiah, or 1st and 2nd Ezra, whatever you want to call them, might be the same author as that of Chronicles. But that's a minority opinion. That's probably not so. Anyway, the books are tightly linked with each other and may even be part units of the same text, in a sense. So that's all I wanted to say about that. That yeah. It makes sense to read them together and study them together because for most of their history, or at least for half of their history, they've been regarded as two parts of the same book.
Yeah, and then just to be clear that they're very similar in terms of how they were written and what they were written about and how who wrote them. But Ezra and Nehemiah were two real people, separate individuals.
Right.
And I think, Stephen, you mentioned before Ezra was a scribe. Or sorry, maybe that was you, Dan. Ezra was a scribe. Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the Persian king. Yep. So were both of them kind of raised in exile in Persia?
It seems to be so. It's much more obvious with Nehemiah, obviously, is explicit, right, that he was in the Persian court. Ezra, it seems likely that he also was, you know, coming from the exile with others. Since they're contemporaries, since they're working at the same time, and they're both returning to Jerusalem at roughly the same time, I think Ezra comes before Nehemiah. I think he returns before him, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. It seems like that they both, you know, were under exilic influence, under Persian influence. One of the reasons why, what am I trying to think here? There's an interesting thing. I think it's in Nehemiah where Ezra, he reads the law to the people, and then it has to be read to the individuals in the audience in Aramaic.
Yeah.
He's probably reading it in Hebrew, but it has to be read to them in Aramaic. And so Ezra is still able to maintain sort of at least a priestly sort of, I guess, elite status, because he still knows Hebrew, right? The common folk of the day most likely had lost their Hebrew and were speaking strictly Aramaic. But the fact that Ezra still knows this, and his capacity to be able to know this, suggests he may have been in a similar situation with Nehemiah, where he's in some position where he can study this, a priestly, scribal, elite class, and that would have only been afforded to him under special circumstances if he was in the exile. We know that from the book of Daniel that that Nebuchadnezzar, this is going a little bit back, but we know that some certain Jews were kept in special positions within the government in Babylon. Daniel and his buddies, for example, are kept on retainer in the king's court. Esther, of course, is a Jew who has very special status, in the Persian court. So it seems likely that Ezra is coming from a similar position because of his priestly, scribal, elite status. He knows this sort of archaic, scribal language, Hebrew, that other people don't know, and he's able to do these sort of, legalistic sort of procedures. And that suggests that he was like Nehemiah in a similar position.
And frankly, the fact that he's literate, I mean, we don't know what the literacy rates were, but in the ancient world, it wasn't so important to be literate. We see it as essential, but for most people, there weren't that many books. There wasn't much to read. You could function very, very well, for the most part, just not reading, or being able to make a mark or so, keep a ledger or something like that, but not to be able to read complex texts was probably a minority skill in any event, and to read it in a language that you no longer spoke, that would be altogether different, really. It'd be, like a Spanish speaker reading Latin. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a related language, but no one speaks it anymore. It wouldn't be anything like what you heard on the street. That gives him a certain status. And there again, that's part of the transition. Being a rabbi involves special skills. Most Jews don't read Hebrew well enough to be able to read the Torah or the Talmud in the original Hebrew or Aramaic or whatever it happens to be. So that makes a learned clerical class, a clergy class, distinct from a priestly class. In Ezra's case, it happens to be in the same person. That won't always be so. Eventually, non-priestly learned people will come along who can read the text. The Pharisees are like that. Sadducees were the priestly group in the New Testament, but the Pharisees were the learned, the lawyers, the scribes, and so on. I might say about Nehemiah, too, that Nehemiah is not a priest, and that will help to make sense of one really peculiar little story in Nehemiah 6, where there's a fellow who comes to him and says, look, this is about what, verse 10 of chapter 6, a fellow by the name of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, comes to him and says, look, let's go hide in the temple. Your life is in danger. People want to kill you. And Nehemiah refuses and says, I won't do this. Verse 11, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Well, why would he say that? Because he's not a priest. He doesn't have the right to go into the temple, not even to save his life. And of course, if he had shown that kind of cowardice, in effect, in the face of the threats against him, he would have discredited himself and probably lowered morale. But he won't go into the temple because he doesn't have that right. He's a government official. He's got government authority behind him, the authority of the king. But he is not a priest. By the way, when we say that he was the cupbearer to the king, that's an important role. It may sound sort of silly, like he's just, he's a waiter or something like that. But it's not only that. He was the one who probably also had to taste the king's food and his wine to make sure that he wasn't being poisoned. And there's that was to be taken seriously. Xerxes was killed by a member of the court, one of the predecessor Persian kings. So it was always a threat that somebody would put something in your wine or in your food, and so you have a taster. But you've got to trust him. If you can't trust him, you've got no security at all. So this is a position of some confidence, but it's not a priestly position.
Can I point out one more thing real quick, Cassandra?
Oh, go ahead, yeah.
I feel kind of silly because I just realized this now, but Ezra is absolutely being commissioned by the Persians. And you know this because of Ezra 7, where he's given a letter by Artaxerxes to go back to Jerusalem and reestablish, you know, the cult.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's pretty explicit too, right? He's being commissioned by Artaxerxes, and he's being told to go back. So he clearly has a position of some kind within the Persian court, as Nehemiah does. Beginning of verse 11, it says, and this is in Ezra 7, "This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave to the priest Ezra, the scribe, a scholar of the text of the commandments of the Lord and his statutes for Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to the priest Ezra, the scribe of the law of the God, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, peace. And now I decree that any of the people of the Israel, or their priests or Levites in my kingdom, who freely offers to go to Jerusalem may go with you. For you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to make inquiries about Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand," etc., etc. So he's clearly getting a commission by the Persians to go do this. And feasibly, I think that could only have happened if Ezra was in a position within the Persian court or the administration where they could trust him enough to do this, right? They're not going to give this kind of a job to any random schmo on the street. They even list his credentials. He's a scribe, he's a priest, he knows the language, he knows the texts, and so he's the guy to do this. So I think that answers clearly, you know, what Ezra's position was.
Yeah.
And then going back to Nehemiah really quick, Dan, you were talking about an account in Nehemiah chapter 6, and just showing what kind of guy Nehemiah was, not a priest, not really anything other than a government official. And the only time that I remember hearing about Nehemiah in General Conference was just a few years ago in 2008, Elder Hales. And this doesn't really fit in with what we were talking about, so sorry, this is kind of a leap. But Nehemiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, Elder Hales quoted this, used this story in his talk in General Conference. The title of the talk was Christian and Courage. And so they are building the walls around Jerusalem so that the city can be safe. Let's see. So Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arabian, and the rest of our enemies heard they were building a wall and that there wasn't any breach in the wall. They hadn't put the doors in the gates yet. And Sanballat and Geshem came to me, Nehemiah, saying, "Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me mischief. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, "I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you?" And they sent to him four times after this sort, and he answered in the same manner four times, "I'm doing great work, I'm not going to come down." And Elder Hales also tied that into the Book of Mormon. I love finding similarities there with the story of Wahantai, who answered at first the same, but then foolishly, and said, "No, we're not going to come down. We are fixed in our minds with a determined resolution that we were going to stay on our mountain." But finally he gave in and said, "Yeah, okay, we'll go join you in attacking or usurping the Lamanite king." So anyway, I'll link to that in the post for this, just for the Nehemiah building the walls, staying focused, doing what you're supposed to do. Don't come down. You're doing a great work. You don't have time for mischief. I love that word. Mm-hmm. So there's one story with practical application from these chapters.
Yeah, I love that verse 3. I'm doing a great work, so I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? It's one thing to keep in mind when dealing with critics of the church, frankly. I mean, yes, it's important to give an answer when you can. But if they're not serious questions, if they're not honest-hearted, sincere questions, then at a certain point you have to say, look, there's positive work to do. I'm not going to allow my life to be taken over by this. Get back to your family, building the kingdom, and you know, you're perfectly willing to answer sincere questions, but not to just squabble with people who will never be satisfied by an answer. I've thought of this verse many times in terms of internet discussions, for example. Never skip the temple to deal with somebody who just wants to fight with you on the internet, right? And but you can devote your entire life to people like this who will never be satisfied by any answer they receive. That's not to say you shouldn't deal with honest, sincere questions, but but there are many others who are not interested in that kind of thing. And right after that, by the way, they make a fifth attempt to get him to come down to this plain of Ono, which is probably down by the, if anyone's been to Israel in the audience out there, they've been pretty near the plain of Ono, which is probably down by Lod, by the airport, the Ben-Gurion airport in Israel today. But this time, Sanballat sends a letter to him, a fifth, in like manner, the fifth time, but with an open letter in his hand. And what is it? It's accusing him of being a rebel, that he wants to set himself up to be a king. And the reason it's an open letter, it's unsealed. You don't seal it because you want other people to know about it. He's spreading rumors about Nehemiah's ambitions. Nehemiah is trying to set himself up as a king. And that's a way of, you know, creating some distrust between Nehemiah and his people. That's what Sanballat is trying to do there with that open letter that he's sending about, you know, you're trying to set yourself up as a new monarch. So, you know, there's a lot going on here. Sanballat is a classic non-sincere questioner. He doesn't really want to have an open discussion. He wants to lure Nehemiah out somewhere where he can get it, or at least discredit him and undermine his support among his people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Elderhill's made a very similar point, too, just about our own motivations. As we're in the Nehemiah role, sometimes it is appropriate to engage with people who are, you know, down on the plain of Ono, asking us questions, trying to get us into a discussion. But we just have to be careful that our own motivation is a desire to help and an appropriate judgment that this is a good way to accomplish that, and that our motivation is not to be argumentative and to show how very clever we are. Trouble very fast, and contention is of the devil.
I think that everybody who's engaged in this kind of discussion, whether it's a missionary or online or whatever, knows in his or her heart of hearts when you've crossed the line between trying to defend the church or trying to explain a difficult or resisted concept to someone who really is trying to understand, really wants to know. Mm-hmm. And when you've crossed that line and gone over into just fighting, because darn it, you want to win.
Yeah.
And that's the point where it's time to probably just say, okay, I'm out of here.
Yeah. And then there is one more book included in this lesson. Do either of you have anything to tell us about, well, first, how to pronounce it? Haggai.
You know, that reminds me, Cassandra, about something very humorous I just read not too long ago. There was a website, it was sort of satirical. They had a satirical post about, like, the top 10 things for single LDS guys to attract girls in Sunday school, right? And it's a very satirical list, you know, to do all these, like, egg-headed smarter. And one of them was to casually name-drop prophets that you don't read, like, oh, I was reading the book of Haggai the other day. These are the things that you just don't hear people saying these days, right? It just reminded me of that, so that was pretty good.
Just ponder carefully what sort of girl you want to attract.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that reminds me of something one of my professors said. He said, if you're ever in a Sunday school lesson and you want to sound really smart and you want to get away with some kind of wild claim, you could always couch it by saying, well, there's an old Jewish legend that says, or you could say, well, Josephus said, you know, and then go and quote whatever you want to say, right? It's all part of this game of just sounding smarter than you are. So.
Right. Most people out there don't know.
Bravo.
Most people out there don't know, and even if they've read Josephus, good grief, Josephus says so many things.
Yeah.
You know, if you say that he said X, even people who've read it will think, I don't remember that, but I don't dare say he didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Josephus wrote a lot. It's a big collection of stuff. Well, Haggai is a contemporary of, he's there in Jerusalem at the same time that all of this stuff is going on. And he's really interesting. We have one chapter, I think, that was listed as additional reading that people could do for this chapter, which I know all Gospel Doctrine class members will do, because no one ever comes to Gospel Doctrine class without having read the lesson and all the additional passages. But it's interesting because clearly what's happened is the people haven't given themselves over to building the temple with sufficient zeal. And so Haggai says to them about the temple, you know, you haven't built the temple yet. This people say, verse 2 of chapter 1 of Haggai, this people say, the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. You know, we'll get to it one of these years. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, you know, the houses with nice ceilings, and this house be waste? So he says, because of that, I'm going to stop the rain. You're not going to get good harvest. You wonder why you've been living so poorly here. Ye looked for much, verse 9, and lo, it came to little, and when he brought it home, I did blow upon it. In other words, I blew it away. Why, saith the Lord of hosts? Because of mine house that is waste, and ye run every man into unto his own house. Therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. You're so concerned about clothing yourselves and taking care of yourselves, but you haven't built the temple, and that's what you need to do. And so that's Haggai comes along as he's giving them a prophetic pep talk. Don't forget what's really important here. Don't be building elaborate, nice houses for yourselves when the temple is still lying in ruins. Get to work on the right things.
Yeah, I'll just note, we're not sure what Haggai's name is etymologically. It's kind of a bizarre name, but some scholars think it's from the Hebrew verb hagag, which is to make a pilgrimage. And if that's the case, then it's understandable why he would be concerned with making sure that the temple is you know, rededicated.
Yeah.
He very much has this sort of one-track mind of getting the temple rededicated. In that sense, it kind of harkens back to the problem that David had, right, where he says, I'm living in this giant palace, and God's living in a tent back in Shiloh, right? You know, we got to do something about that. So Haggai is kind of in that same mindset, right? He's going to be a great drive towards, as Dan said, prepping, giving the prophetic prep speech about the temple and the fact that we need it. Need it now. And that's going to, of course, pan out eventually, but Haggai is really going to kickstart that, right, and get the people on that track.
You know, you mentioned that his name, one explanation that's been proposed for his name is it has something to do with festivals of pilgrimage. There's a modern word that many people know, which is the Hajj. H-A-J-J, it's often transliterated. Or in Egypt, you'd even pronounce it Hag. It would be H-A-G-G, like Haggai. And that's, of course, the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. It's a related word, same root.
Oh, very cool. All right, well, I think we should start toward wrapping it up. And so, one more question for you both. The theme of this lesson is building. Going back to their homeland, to Jerusalem, building the walls to protect the city, building the temple within those walls. What does this teach you practically in your lives today about building temples, building a Christ-like life? Any thoughts on that?
I'll just mention something briefly. You know, one thing I've really appreciated Mormonism for is it's a very pragmatic religion. I really admire Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, especially for how pragmatic and sort of practical they are in getting the job done, right? My understanding is most of the times in our lives, and I think this is true in the gospel, I think it's very rare when God's going to directly intervene in some, like, you know, dramatic, miraculous, you know, manner, right, to sort of deliver us from our problems. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I just think it's more rare. It's done, you know, it's very rarely done. And the reason I think it is I believe that God gives us the means, the opportunities to accomplish our work, but he ultimately lets us do it for our own embetterment, for our own growth and development. We need to be the ones who take the initiative and who use the resources and opportunities given to us by the Lord to build up our lives, build up the church, you know, and so forth. And if you look at these chapters in that sense, I think it begins to, you know, bring a new significance to what's going on here. The Lord has raised up this Gentile king, Cyrus, who you know, sort of miraculously says everybody's allowed to go back to their homeland and worship their god again. And it would have been really easy, and perhaps a lot of the exiles did this, it would have been really easy to sort of sit around and say, well, you know, it's nice here in Babylon, you know, it's not a big deal anyways, we've got a nice cushy life, we can just sort of chill out here. There may have been those that did that, but look what, you know, the overwhelming response was to take this opportunity and work hard to accomplish it, right? Take the blessings the Lord had given and work to do their best to build up Jerusalem, to build the temple, and receive those blessings again. And I think that's with our lives, our callings in the church, our families, our friendships and relationships. We shouldn't just sit back and sort of coax and let the Lord do everything for us. We should be, as the Doctrine and Covenants says, anxiously engaged in doing a good work and in doing the work we need to get done. So I would say read it, you know, with that lens to appreciate what's going on here and how we can sort of apply this in our own lives today.
You know, building on that a little bit, I think this idea of building is so important. It's been fundamental to the Latter-day Saint identity. For Latter-day Saints, it's not just a matter of prayer and scripture reading, but of getting your hands dirty, and certainly in the 19th century, digging irrigation canals and colonizing deserts and building buildings, building not only temples, but building homes was part of worship. We were called upon to build, and we still are. It's not enough. We don't believe in withdrawing into a monastery or an abbey or something, a convent, and simply praying and chanting hymns, singing psalms all day. It's also a matter of getting out there and doing work, working in the welfare cannery, whatever it happens to be, working on the welfare farm, fixing a widow's house, all those sorts of things. So we aren't usually called on building missions anymore. But there are still people alive who were called on such missions. There are still people around who helped build their chapels. Now with modern building codes, at least you wouldn't want me anywhere near a building site. Right. But that spirit is still there. And so this idea that they came back and part of their worship of God was to rebuild the temple, rebuild the walls of the city, you know, build up the city of Jerusalem again as the city of God. That, I think, is still has a lesson for us today. And I love the passage in Nehemiah chapter 4 where Nehemiah describes the builders of the wall, that everyone had his sword girded by his side and so builded. Or they had a sword in one hand and they built with the other hand. You know, you've got to defend and you've got to build. To me, you know, being involved in apologetics and so on, that's part of it. You've got to defend the claims, and you've also got to do the work. It's not enough to sit around. I know one rather eccentric person who, as far as I can tell, doesn't come to church, but he spends all of his time on the internet defending the kingdom. I don't get it. That's not right. On the other hand, you can't just go to church and refuse to ever speak up in defense of your beliefs. I mean, not everyone has to be an internet apologist, but when the time comes, every man is supposed to give a reason for the hope that is within him, as Peter says. Every man and every woman, every disciple of Christ. And so that's really, that I think is really important. So anyway, that's at least some thought.
Thank you. Really, since I'll just add my thought that both of you gave me to start thinking while you were talking, just how I think, Stephen, when you were talking about everyone is busy, you have to get out there, be practical, do the practical things, go swing a hammer, have your sword girded, ready for use, and also just kind of the symbol of going back to Jerusalem, you have the temple in the center of the city, and then you have the walls around the temple to protect it, which is, I mean, could be a metaphor for a lot of things for our lives, but I am thinking about our homes, that, you know, the temple, the spiritual center of our home should be like a temple. The home is a sacred place, and then the walls around it, not that we wall off our homes, but there should be defenses that are consciously built and maintained and designed to keep harmful influences out of our homes. out of our lives. And so what are we consciously building every day? How are our lives structured and scheduled in order to accomplish a great work? Like Nehemiah said, I'm not just drifting from day to day, but making something meaningful happen. Something meaningful, specifically making a life built on the gospel of Jesus Christ happen, and a family that is built on the principles of the gospel, and a family that is centered on the temple and fortified by those walls, and then also go out, reach out, and help others. So help other people build their homes and bring the gospel to others. So yes, thank you both very much.
You know, may I just add something to that, or detract from it, maybe, who knows? It occurs to me that the walls of the home ought to be temple-like, certainly in this sense. There are certain things that ought simply never to pass them. It's one of the many reasons for objecting to pornography, and particularly internet pornography that can now so easily come through a wall, but should not. But another thing, maybe less obvious than this, is that quite often we're out there in the world, and the world is stressful, and the world is irritating, and there are sometimes not so very nice people out there, or frustrating people. And what we often do is we're on our good behavior when we're out in public. And then, ironically, it's when we come home that we often unload. Cut loose the tensions of the day, and we let loose on somebody who maybe isn't even responsible for it, but it's finally somebody that we can tell off. We can just, you know, let it go. And that's the opposite.
They'll love you and forgive you if you treat them badly.
Yeah. We're a public person. If you did that to your boss, that would be it. It would be over. But you know you can say things like that to your wife or to your husband or to your children or to your parents, and they'll still probably love you. And so we do that. We often let our guard down with the very people where we ought to be most careful not to misbehave. And our good behavior is reserved for strangers, in a way who, you know, not that they don't matter, but in a sense, relatively speaking, they don't. So
yeah,
that's one way in which the home ought to be temple-like, I think. There are just certain things we don't bring into the temple. We don't even bring them into the chapel. You just wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain things that just should not come into the home.
Yeah. I brag about my husband a lot, that would be gross. But it's just that he is very kind, unfailingly kind. You know, there are a lot of things that you can say about a person and what you love about your spouse, but he never cuts me down, he never uses sarcasm, he never gets angry and says mean things for the heck of it. And it's, I mean, I knew going into marriage that he had that trait, but I've just come to appreciate how incredibly precious that is, that kindness.
Yeah. And that's the spirit of the temple, in a way. You don't hear people yelling at each other in the temple. You don't often hear anger in the temple. There's kindness and helpfulness and so on, because we don't bring those things in with us. We know better. We should know better in our homes, too.
Yep. Stephen, any thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I thought you both said that very well.
Well, thank you. All right. Well, this has been the 97th Scripture Roundtable of the Interpreter Foundation. I think when we get to number 100, we should have, like, some confetti or something. We have been discussing Lesson 47 of the Old Testament Gospel Doctrine Manual. I'm Dan Peterson, Stephen Smoot, and I am Cassandra Hedelius. Thank you all very much for joining us, and we hope that this will help you in your study and or teaching.